search and rescue teams worked Thursday in eastern Libya, where devastating floods left thousands of people dead and thousands more missing.
And two-thirds of the city, they were supposed to be repaired like 2 years ago.
Plus, analysts say Libyans were left helpless after years of conflict, political divisions, and neglect.
Conflict and division and administrative malfeasance, misgovernance, hitting this very vulnerable area. All of this converged to create a terribly catastrophic situation.
And House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is lashing out at his party's hardline flank.
Some hardline conservatives like Matt Gaetz say the GOP has a choice. Either force McCarthy to live up to promises he made to become speaker
or remove you.
This is Friday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Search and rescue teams worked Thursday in eastern Libya, where devastating floods left at least 11,000 people dead and thousands more missing. Abdel Raham El-Ghaithi, the mayor of the city of Derna, told Al Arabiya Television that the death toll could reach 20,000. Two brothers who survived the rushing water that swept away part of Derna said they were speechless at the scale of the disaster as rescue operations continued. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamas reports.
Mubarak El-Ghaithi told British broadcaster Sky in a video call from Derna that he and his brother were still in shock.
We're speechless.
Libyan health officials have confirmed 5,500 deaths and say 9,000 people are still missing. Mubarak blamed authorities for not dealing with maintenance of the dams that collapsed from the flooding.
The two dams of the city, they were supposed to be repaired like 2 years ago.
His brother Safwat said the floods have devastated their town.
We lost a lot of people. We lost our memories. We lost our city.
The Libyan city of Derna has buried thousands of people in mass graves as search teams scoured ruins left by the devastating floods. I'm Karen Chamas.
Analysts say years of conflict, political divisions, and neglect rendered Libya helpless as torrential rains from powerful storm Daniel burst two dams and swept entire neighborhoods into the Mediterranean Sea. For VOA, Dale Gavlik reports on the factors that have made Daniel especially devastating for Libya.
Storm Daniel unleashed its devastation on eastern Libyan towns, uprooting roads and homes, while destroying two dams near the coastal city of Derna, where entire neighborhoods were swept into the Mediterranean. A Libyan official told the Associated Press that bodies are lying everywhere, in the sea, in the valleys, under the buildings. Stephanie Williams, a non-resident senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, served as a UN special advisor on Libya. Familiar with the stricken region, Williams told VOA it goes beyond a climate crisis-induced catastrophe, which has been compounded.
Conflict and division and administrative malfeasance, misgovernance, hitting this very vulnerable area. All of this converged to create a terribly catastrophic situation. Political instability, quite complicating in this environment, and I'm sure that there will be many who will want to play the blame game.
Saudi Arabia's Arab News newspaper said the startling death and devastation caused by the storm's intensity also exposed Libya's vulnerability after being divided between rival governments and torn apart by chaos for more than a decade. Libya, for the past 10 years, has gone from one war to another, one political crisis to another. Claudia Gazzini, a senior Libya analyst for the International Crisis Group, told the New York Times newspaper, "Essentially, this has meant that for the past 10 years, there hasn't really been much investment in the country's infrastructure," Gazzini said. Malak El-Tayeb, an analyst with Washington's Middle East Institute, told VOA that conflict and unrest have left social services severely weakened and a failure to maintain facilities like dams. Unfortunately, there were no mitigation strategies, early warning systems, or evacuation plans in place, he wrote in an emailed reply of the disaster in Derna, about 900 kilometers east of the capital, Tripoli, an area controlled by military commander Khalifa Haftar's forces. No measures were taken to protect civilians or reduce damage, El-Tayeb said. But Brookings analyst William said that despite the geopolitical divide, the rival internationally recognized government based in Tripoli in western Libya and allied with other armed groups is coming to the east's aid.
There's a great outreach from all Libyans to the people, particularly in Derna. The internationally recognized government in Tripoli has sent assistance, is allocating funds to help with the immediate humanitarian needs and long-term rebuilding.
William says desperately needed aid is also reaching people by civilian convoys from western Libya and by the national oil company to Libyans in the east. The division right now is not a barrier to assistance, she said. World Health Organization spokesperson Margaret Harris describes the flooding as being of epic proportions. Concerns have also arisen that migrants and refugees from more than 40 countries who use Libya as a launch point for Europe may have been caught up in the floods. Dale Gavlek, VOA News, Amman.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is lashing out at the Republican Party's hard-right members as he tries to lead a fractured majority. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Some hardline conservatives like Matt Gaetz say the GOP has a choice, either force McCarthy to live up to promises he made to become speaker
or remove you.
People in a private Republican meeting this morning say McCarthy dared them to do it, using an expletive.
I showed frustration in here because I am frustrated with the committee. I'm frustrated with some people in the conference.
McCarthy's facing a hard right element that's threatening to shut down the government over spending cut demands, and one that's not appeased by his impeachment inquiry against President Biden. McCarthy says he will survive.
And you know what? If it takes a fight, I'll have a fight.
Top House Democrat Akeem Jeffries says that's the problem. Republicans are too busy fighting each other instead of fighting for Americans.
It's sad. It's dangerous. And it's pathetic.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Hunter Biden has been indicted on federal firearms charges. It's the latest step in a long-running investigation into the president's son that puts the case on track toward a possible high-stakes trial as the 2024 election looms. Biden is accused of lying about his drug use when he bought a firearm in October 2018, a period when he has acknowledged struggling with addiction to crack cocaine, according to the indictment filed in federal court in Delaware by a special counsel overseeing the case. The indictment comes weeks after the collapse of a plea deal that would have averted a criminal trial and weeks or months of distracting headlines for President Biden. The U.S. government on Thursday imposed sanctions on 150 companies and individuals it accuses of helping Russia's war effort against Ukraine. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
The Departments of State and Treasury have announced a new round of sweeping sanctions on those the U.S. government accuses of sanctions evasion and circumvention to help Russia wage war against Ukraine. Of particular focus is Russia's energy industry, with sanctions targeting the country's energy production and export capacity, as well as Russia's metal and mining sectors. Matthew Miller is a spokesman for the State Department.
The department also designated numerous entities producing and repairing Russian weapon systems, including the Kalibr cruise missile used by Russian forces against cities and civilian infrastructure in Ukraine.
Also sanctioned are those affiliated with the Wagner Group militia alleged to have shipped munitions from North Korea to Russia, and those helping advance Russian malign activities in the Central African Republic. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Russia is expelling two U.S. diplomats. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Russia is expelling two U.S. diplomats. Russia has ordered two U.S. diplomats to leave the country within 7 days, accusing them of keeping in touch with a man in Russia who worked at the U.S. consulate in Vladivostok, but was arrested earlier this year. The ex-employee was accused of collecting information for U.S. diplomats about Russia's military action in Ukraine and related issues. The two U.S. diplomats ordered to leave are the first secretary at the U.S. Embassy in Russia, Jeffrey Sillin, and the second secretary, David Bernstein. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement that the U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, has been informed of this and told that what it called the illegal activities of the U.S. diplomatic mission are unacceptable, and the Moscow expects Washington to, quote, refrain from confrontational steps. I'm Rita Foley.
Kim Jong-un invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to visit North Korea during a rare summit, stoking U.S. concerns that a revived Moscow-Pyongyang axis could bolster Russia's military in Ukraine and provide Kim sensitive missile technology. Reuters' Rachel Judah has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has gratefully accepted Kim Jong-un's invitation to visit North Korea after the pair held a rare summit in Russia's Far East. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov confirmed the invitation on Thursday, saying Russia intended to build good relations with its neighbor. He added that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was expected to visit Pyongyang next month. The summit has stoked U.S. concerns that a revived Moscow-Pyongyang axis could bolster Russia's military in Ukraine and provide Kim with sensitive missile technology. In Wednesday's talks, Kim and Putin discussed military matters, the war in Ukraine, and Russian help for North Korea's satellite program. Washington has accused North Korea of providing arms to Russia, but it is unclear whether any deliveries have been made. Both countries have denied those claims. North Korea is believed to have a large stockpile of artillery shells and rockets compatible with Soviet-era weapons, as well as a history of producing such ammunition. Amid artillery battles in Ukraine, Russia has ramped up its shell production, but a North Korea supply line could be useful. The U.S. State Department said the Biden administration won't hesitate to impose additional sanctions on Russia and North Korea if they conclude any new arms deals.
That's Reuters' Rachel Judah. We're following these other stories from around the world. Hurricane Lee, which formed September 6th in the Atlantic Ocean before becoming a Category 5 storm, continued north Thursday, triggering tropical storm warnings in Bermuda and threatening the northeast United States and Canada with a Saturday landfall. For decades, preventing dengue fever in Honduras has meant teaching people to fear mosquitoes and avoid their bites. Now Hondurans are being educated about a potentially more effective way to control the disease, and it goes against everything they've learned. Volker Perthes, the United Nations top envoy in Sudan, is stepping down, or months after being told by the government to leave. In parting remarks, he criticized Sudan's military and the rebel Rapid Support Forces. He told the UN Security Council on Wednesday that this conflict is leaving a tragic legacy of human rights abuses. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I am Rick Pantaleo. The first truckload of Russian humanitarian aid has arrived this week in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh from Azerbaijan, although Armenian authorities, citizens, and activists say that the Azerbaijani troops continue to block access from Armenia. Reporter Ricardo Marquina traveled to areas near the enclave on the Armenian side. Marcus Harton narrates his report from the Armenian capital, Yerevan.
After a total blockade since December, the first truckload of humanitarian aid has entered the separatist Nagorno-Karabakh enclave through Azerbaijan. The aid from Russia started to flow after Armenian and Azerbaijani negotiators started talks to fully reopen the passage to this self-declared republic. Meanwhile, the Lachin Corridor, linking Armenia to Karabakh, remained closed on Wednesday. The situation of tens of thousands of citizens trapped within the separatist enclave is critical, and the shortages could soon begin to cost lives. From Stepanakert, the capital of the region, Ruben Vardanyan, a local politician and public figure, speaks with VOA.
We have limited food because of the only local products. We don't have medicaments. We don't have gasoline. And every day situation becoming worse and worse.
Residents on the Armenian side of the border say the Russians are not meeting their obligations under a 2020 agreement to secure the corridor with a presence of peacekeepers. Azerbaijani officials say the corridor is open. International organizations working in the area say it is not, and they say a humanitarian crisis is underway. The Armenian Red Cross Society's Secretary General Anna Yegyazarian tells VOA all parties should find a way out to avoid a full-scale humanitarian disaster.
our, let's say, main call would be for the decision makers to reach a humanitarian consensus to, for the ICRC to be able to continue bringing in humanitarian aid as much as it is needed, either through Lachin Corridor or through any other routes that will be agreed and secured.
Until that solution arrives, families like Nona Gazarian's will continue to be divided. She was visiting Yerevan when the blockade began and has not seen her mother and her brothers for months. She says she suffers when she thinks about the situation of her family in Nagorno-Karabakh. She says there has been no bread for 2 days running. Today, each person received 200 grams of bread, not enough salt or butter. The children are in need of everything. Negotiations are underway, and the Lachin Corridor could soon open, giving hope for the thousands of people trapped without enough food or medicines inside Nagorno-Karabakh. For Ricardo Marquina in Yerevan, Armenia, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
A Philippine court on Tuesday acquitted Maria Ressa and her news website, Rappler, in a tax case. The Nobel laureate is fighting two other challenges. VOA News reporter Christina Quesada-Smith has the story.
Optimistic but still cautious, journalist Maria Ressa was happy Tuesday with a Philippine court ruling that acquitted her of a tax evasion charge. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate and co-founder of the independent news website Rappler spoke with reporters outside the court.
The acquittal now strengthens our resolve to continue with the justice system, to submit ourselves to the court despite the political harassment, despite the attacks on press freedom. It shows that the court system works, and we hope to see the remaining charges dismissed.
Ressa and her multimedia news outlet Rappler were vocal critics of former President Rodrigo Duterte and his government's so-called war on drugs in 2016, a lethal campaign that left thousands dead. She and Rappler have been hit with lawsuits, investigated and harassed online in relation for their coverage. Media advocates say Duterte's administration, which ended in June 2022, had denied that was the case. Ressa's legal team said that such charges were a way of weaponizing the law, but that they were ultimately pleased with Tuesday's outcome. Eric Recalde is a lawyer for Maria Ressa.
Okay, actually, this is one of the five cases, tax evasion cases, filed by the government in relation to the PDR transactions of Rappler Holdings Corporation. So we're thankful that the court finally dismissed the fifth one, and hopefully that's the end of it.
Two more legal cases are pending. Ressa is appealing a 6-year jail term for cyber libel, and Rappler is fighting a closure order. After years of fighting legal challenges, Ressa had this to say to other journalists.
We hold the line, and this proved that we can hold the line.
Her reminder serves for journalists not only in the Philippines, but everywhere that media freedom is under threat. Christina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
Australia's National Science Agency has installed specialized sensors in the southern section of the Great Barrier Reef to help monitor and forecast sediment runoff. Experts from the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization say the discharge can harm the marine ecosystem, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Researchers from the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, say their system of sensors, installed over recent months in the southern section of the Great Barrier Reef, the first such system in the world, checks water quality using a combination of specialized sensors and satellite data. Details of the so-called mission were released Wednesday. Experts hope to develop an integrated ground-to-space water quality monitoring network using sensors in the water and existing Earth observation satellites. Artificial intelligence would also be used to help analyze the data. They say Australia's coastal and inland waterways quality is being threatened by global warming, urbanisation, deforestation and contamination. The system analyses the flow of sediment and dissolved organic carbon from the Fitzroy River into Keppel Bay in central Queensland, which is in the southern region of the Great Barrier Reef. The system is designed to provide an early warning of the presence of harmful algae and contaminants. The reef is one of seven test sites for CSIRO's AquaWatch Australia mission. This is the name of the ground-to-space water monitoring project. The research team hopes to have up to 15 sites testing the system by 2026. Alex Held, the head of the project, told VOA Thursday that sediments can stop sunlight from reaching the sea floor. Held said the sensors and satellites will monitor the effectiveness of programs to reduce runoff of river sediment into the sea.
There are a number of government programs already in place to help with that. They would include maintaining vegetation along riverbeds and small tributaries so that the sediments and the erosion is reduced. So the government is already doing quite a bit of that.
The Great Barrier Reef faces a range of threats, including climate change, pollution and farm pesticide and fertilizer runoff, as well as coral-eating crown-of-thorn starfish. The world's largest coral system runs 2,300 kilometres off Australia's northeast coastline and was included on the UN's World Heritage List in 1981. It is the only living thing visible from space. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Between September 15th and October 15th, the United States celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month. It's an opportunity to recognize the histories, cultures, and contributions of those United States citizens whose ancestors came from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. The observance began in 1968 as Hispanic Heritage Week and was expanded by law in 1988 to a month-long event. American identity is a fabric of diverse traditions and stories woven together, said President Joe Biden last year in a written statement. Since the beginning, our country has drawn strength and insight from Hispanic writers, scientists, soldiers, doctors, entrepreneurs, academics, and leaders in labor and government. Our culture has been enriched by the rhythms, art, literature, and creativity of Hispanic peoples. Hispanic history is American history, said President Biden.
It's a history that beats in the soul of our nation and that lives in the dreams of those who've only just arrived, a legacy of families who've been here for generations.
Indeed, Hispanic Americans have had a profound influence on the development of the United States. They laid the foundation of some of our greatest cities, including San Antonio, Albuquerque, Tucson, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. They have served honorably in the United States Armed Forces, defending the values Americans hold dear. They have transformed industries with innovative ideas, and they have led and inspired movements that have pushed the country towards greater equality and a more just society. I've always said America is defined by one word, said President Biden. Possibilities. Anything is possible here.
The possibilities that exist are no more evident anywhere than in the Hispanic community in the United States. Courage and character reflects who we are as a nation, a great nation, because we are a good people.
We're the only nation built on an idea. Every other nation is built on geography, ethnicity, or religion, or whatever. But we're the only one based on an idea, said President Biden. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty. That's who we are. That's the nation. We are a nation of immigrants.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.